Hello, my name's Brian Dwyer. This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. With me tonight, Lee Kelly and Kathy Donovan. How are you today?
Good.
And it's a bit of a special day because we're hoping Isabel Carmody is coming in. She's racing back from Bendigo. She's been at the Bendigo Writers Festival.
So
we're hoping to have her on the program. And in preparation for Isabel, we've got Randall Fitzgerald waiting to have that conversation. So welcome to Randall as well. What have you been reading, Lee Kelly?
Well, I've been working a bit lately, so my reading's taken a bit of a dive, but I've launched into Magda Szymanski's Reckoning, or The Reckoning, which I'm really enjoying at the moment. I know we've talked previously about, biography or memoir and how some people, don't get really attracted to that genre. But I think, in the right hands, it can be fascinating because you're not hearing a person's whole life. You're just hearing snippets and little sections that have been particularly memorable for them.
Yes.
And I listened to it actually on audio tape driving to and from Melbourne over a few different occasions. And what struck me about her book, about The Reckoning, was it wasn't so much about her coming out and her gayness, but also about her relationship with her father.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a really, sometimes traumatic, sometimes self-reflective.
Yeah, and there's some really lovely pieces, as you'd expect from Magda, because she's a very amusing character. So, there's some very poignant moments and sad, but also some very amusing ones. And there was a great story about how her father loved all things Australian. He was one of those people that when they arrived, that's it, suburbia, I'm in.
Yeah.
And that's really funny because she sort of, looks at that and thinks, how could he, having come from sort of cosmopolitan or sort of Warsaw?
I know, a bit like a mad bulldog supporter or something.
She describes how he used to wear these shorts and, they couldn't put him off it. Even though he assimilated into all things Australian, he would wear these shorts. And the way she described them, they almost sounded like sort of purple lederhosen,
almost boxer shorts gone wild,
And he just would not take any sort of criticism of him wearing them, that, that wasn't what Australians wore, Dad.
Yeah.
Friend of mine had to wear them to primary school because he was German, migrant family, Scarred him for life, he says. Sorry, Kathy.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was also interested that the beginning of her putting on weight was almost like a rebellion against her father, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because of his rigid sort of, because he was in the war and, that unfolds in the story.
Yeah.
But he wanted her to have the discipline to be thin and maintain that, and she just...
Yeah, I think that's what makes it such a good read. It's won a few prizes because it's so diverse. Like, you can approach so many different elements in it. There's all that bit about her self-image and why she's had that issue with her weight. But also, like I said, that migrant thing, but also that understanding that your parents are actually adults who've lived a whole life, and the final dawning on you that there's a story behind this person who's just truly dear to you but has had their own mistakes and done their own... I think that's really interesting too.
Yes.
Yeah.
At the recent Apollo Bay Writers Festival, people talked about the difference between biography and memoir.
Yeah.
So it's not... The Reckoning, not a comprehensive account of Magda's life. Is she selective about
I think
the focus?
Selective in the detail that she goes into.
Right.
Some events are obviously have more impact on her, and that's what she spends her time on. And her relationship with her father is obviously been really important to her.
But it does cover a big, it covers from her early childhood right through to her recent life. So it is spanning.
It's an autobiography,
Well, in terms of the length of it, but because she was selective about threads and themes, it's not a, faithful account of every detail of her life.
No, and it's not one of those biographies where you've got someone who's famous telling the story of how they got there.
Yeah.
It's more about a person and all the layers that have contributed to the life and the person that she is.
It's something that mars the biography field. You go to bookstores and you look, you know, and here they are, the sort of household names up on the biography shelf, and you know the books are all rubbish. You do, don't you? You know it's always going to be. And then.
We've got them on our shelves at home. You probably, people, you know, if they know you're a reader, they'll give you whatever. So I've got sort of Maggie Thatcher and all these people. And you think, well, you know, you may well have read An Interesting Life, but it doesn't mean that you've been able to write an interesting biography or memoir because you've just focused on your success rather than.
And they sanitise it. It's purporting to be the truth of their lives, but really it's just, you know, what they thought was seemly to relay.
Well, both of those things, Kathy, do lead us quite neatly to Lee Kaufman.
Yes.
The Dangerous Bride. Do you know this book, Lee?
No, I did remember you hearing you speak about her presentation at the.
Yes.
Well, I believe many in Apollo Bay will have this book because if they went to Warm Winter Words, it was on sale there. And Lee held the life writing workshop, which Brian and I both attended. And we bought the book, though Brian's actually read the whole thing and I've only just dabbled in it a bit. But,
I found it quite compelling. But she made that point that it's not an autobiography, it's a memoir of her sort of struggles, I suppose, with what she calls non-monogamy, which is a fairly broad term. She says since she was a teenager, she had this rebellious idea that monogamy was not for her. And in the workshop, Warm Winter Words, she did explain that it covers a wide field. There are people who have concurrent love affairs. There are polyamorous people who have a life partner plus lovers. Swingers who are sort of sexual adventurers but seem to have limitations on emotional attachments, which is sort of interesting.
She labelled herself a pleasure seeker in the book. She says, I wasn't a huntress, I wasn't a swinger, I was a pleasure seeker.
Yeah. So it's pretty bold, you know, and she talked about this thing about when you write a memoir, you write to convict yourself. You write things which will make you feel ashamed. You know, like she's sort of brutally honest about it, you know.
Maybe that's what we were talking about before, about the attraction of some memoirs where people don't try to aggrandise themselves. They rather, go in warts and all and tell you the real story. You know, there's a sincerity about that that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, in fact, in her workshop, she said, to write about what makes you blush, what makes you ashamed or uncomfortable, this is your best material, and concealing what is shameful to you will never lead to anything of value in your writing. And so I wondered whether you felt that she was faithful to that in her book, Brian. Were you blushing?
I was a bit, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, it's pretty frank, and you're talking about a woman who married a bisexual person who believed in commitment plus sexual freedom.
Yes,
and so, she
chapter to sort out.
In the very beginning of the book, in the first few pages, she actually, you know, because it's 2005, it's set in 2005, she's Jewish, she's in Russia, and she's about to be married in a traditional wedding, and she decides to have a fling with another woman on the eve of her wedding just because she wanted to show that she wasn't conventional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's quite an adventurous person. She left Israel in her mid-20s after a succession of love affairs, and she says she got bored with macho Israeli men. No, they're all too competent and capable and self-confident. She just got bored with them. But oddly enough, when she came to Australia, she hooked up with Israeli men.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But she also says, like in the novel, there's quite a few characters and they're based on people she interviewed in the book or for the book. But Bianca says she was a feminist and independent and wanted to sleep with who she wanted, but for the reason that it flaunted social convention. And yes. That was her motives.
Yes.
And I wonder, do you think that was what she was trying to do, Brian, being Lee?
I suspect that there were two things going. I mean, as you say, she did say she was a pleasure seeker, but she has an ongoing struggle with her mother's overbearing nature. Her mother's a little bit like a stereotype Jewish mother in this book, and she has this sort of battle to not to be dominated by her mother, but she's certainly a pleasure seeker, and it's an interesting thing because the book's not just a memoir of her own experience, but it's the result of interviews she's done with people who lead these various non-monogamous lifestyles. Mm. So they're kind of digressions everywhere, which I think's quite interesting.
She also said in that writing workshop that at the core of every memoir is anxiety, wonder and doubt. So do you think that she actually questioned her morality or questioned her decisions, or was she trying to give you the sense that they were, courageous? Or?
Well, I think that in the case of her two Australian lovers, one she fell in love with, the other one I think it'd be more correct to say that she fell into the relationship, and she sort of knew in both cases that it wasn't really going to work. And I did wonder, reading the book, whether or not she wasn't just a foolhardy person who just sort of went in where angels fear to tread a bit.
Yeah.
I did get that sense, actually, that she was a bit reckless.
Yes. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because social convention, the idea of a monogamous marriage is conventional. It's about commitment. It's about, being in there for the long haul, all those things. And I thought to myself as I was reading the part that I've read, is that just cliche? Is that something that, I mean, I believe it, but am I a cliche? I don't know.
Well, she asks the question, is your life a classic or is it pulp fiction? But she does argue, and quite strenuously, that both of these relationships she had with men in Australia broke down not because of her non-monogamous ways. They broke down for other reasons. And she argues this quite strongly, that the conventional sexual fidelity is not really, that big a deal.
Do you believe her?
I don't think she's established her case, actually.
Mm. It's a bit hard for her, though, as one side of the relationship, to say it broke down for these reasons. But there's another side to that story, isn't it? I mean, she can't answer for the two.
Well, both of the men in question were quite jealous and possessive by the end. Mm. However they started, they ended up being possessive of her and angry about her having lovers. And that's fairly easy to believe, really, isn't it? Mm.
But whatever you say, in response to what she put together, it is courageous to have put all that to paper and then to go around giving workshops and, really bearing your soul to strangers. I admired her immensely.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Because, and the point she also made, this point at the workshop as well as at Warm Winter Words, Kathy, and that is that she was not only interrogating her younger self from, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, or, well, more, almost 20 years ago. She wasn't only interrogating the 26-year-old woman who is herself, but she's also interrogating her current self and still not quite sure what happened, for a start, and not quite sure how she feels about it.
And we all do that, don't we? You know, I look back on my, you know, wilder moments at university and I can probably explain them very rationally to you now.
And isn't it interesting how you phrase it, you know? I mean, you could just say something glib like, oh, well, we had a few adventurous times and, you know, it doesn't sound like much. But if you give us the details, it might...
It is a pleasure of reading to be able to immerse yourself in a world that's not your own. You know, that is somebody who's behaved and done things very differently to your own sort of...
It's like absolutely fabulous when they talk about the 1970s. They say, if you can remember them, you weren't there.
She also raises an interesting question about the ethics of writing memoir, because inevitably people in your memoir are going to be identifiable. Mm. Even if you change names. Anyone who knows you knows who you're talking about. And so she talked about that a bit, about, you know, it's a struggle.
She said if you're going to be creative, because she talked about it as creative autobiography in a way, and she was saying that if you are going to bend or change the facts of the situation, you have to think about the ethics of it and be a bit more faithful to the truth in if it's a memoir than you would if it was a fiction.
And I liked her distinction between factual truth and emotional truth. Sometimes it's necessary to change the actual details in order to get the emotional truth. You know, like it doesn't matter if it was a week later or a day later or something. That's not
well. That's
the point.
A given, really, isn't it? In memoirs too, because you always think that. I remember, you know, starting to read them and thinking, as if you can remember a conversation back from when you were 20 years ago. It'd be like you remember when it took place or who with.
The emotional truth. It's a really, really interesting point, I think. And I think she certainly does, Kathy. I think she certainly does capture that emotional truth. But she said her husband, from whom she was divorced, kind of gave her permission to write the book, but in the same half-hearted way he gave her permission to have affairs. Like he grudgingly said, well, if you must, you know. but the other man... kind of disappeared out of her life. So
that was Jay.
So she has presumably written it without his permission. Interestingly, now she is happily, monogamously married with a child. So does that mean she's a reformed character, I wonder?
Well, what was your conclusion?
I wouldn't surprise me if she's a reformed, changed character. Maybe that.
It was a time of her life that was defined, and she was obviously very affected, as were all the people around her. And it's made her who she is today.
The interesting thing, though, is that she talks about being married and being that she was happily married, but she just couldn't help falling in love with other people. And I think that's probably a fairly common phenomenon, isn't it? To married people.
It's
a very cheeky question.
Well, she might have to write a postscript if she's currently in a monogamous relationship. She needs to write, sort of additional views on that.
So presumably, I don't know, but presumably married people kind of suppress those kinds of things a little bit at least. But she just didn't. She just said, no, I'm not going to suppress it. So it makes pretty interesting reading.
Yeah.
But it's not what's the word? It's not sort of lascivious or scurrilous or anything. It's an intellectual examination. Mm. And her interviews with the polyamorous people are very interesting. You know, the honesty. And she talks about the difficulty of interviewing people about their sex lives. It's like a difficult thing to knock on the door, you know. I've come to ask about your threesome, you know. Yeah.
Well, she said she was trying to live out the dream of love, entailing commitment but also sexual freedom. Hmm. So she gave it a shot.
Yeah, It's a pretty interesting read. The Dangerous Bride by Lee Kaufman. This is the Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. We will be back with Isabel Carmody.
Okay, Randall Fitzgerald here. I've got the pleasure of meeting up with Isabel Carmody after a long, long time, and we're going to have a bit of a chat about her body of work, which I must admit, Isabel, busy as I was today, I actually went onto the internet and without any trouble at all, I found 18 pages popped out at me. I thought, I can't do this research. It's just going to have to be a chat about old times.
Yeah, that's fine.
Which I suppose I should jump forward. What are you doing now? You've just come from the Bendigo Writers Festival.
Yeah, Bendigo Writers Festival. Bendigo Writers Festival and an added on day of workshopping with some locals. So you often add on a day when you do, everybody comes and you have a workshop.
And was that going well? Did it work?
Yeah, it was good. Well, they seem to like it. That's how I judge it. And these days you actually know what you're like. I was just joking with someone that you don't wait for reviews anymore, because if you go and speak, while you're on stage speaking, people are tweeting, she's this or she's that or she just said. So I always know the sweet spots in my talk because they're tweeted. And sometimes there's not many tweets and I think, oh, I mustn't have been very good today. And then sometimes I break the internet and I think, yes, I was good today.
That's funny. So I guess that if something like that's working for you, are you still visiting schools and things and talking to kids?
I would like to say that I'm not doing any, and I'm trying not to do any, but I'm incapable of saying no, basically. I like it. I like working with kids, especially teenagers, although little kids are really sweet, but I love working with the writing of teenagers. And I love seeing what they say, seeing them grasp the realization that this is power, words are power. Mm. And some of them don't know that. Some of them think you're just a ninny up there talking about, you know, elves or something. It's when you start to talk and they really get it, they get the power of it, and you see it start to happen, that's when it's really exciting, because they're going to change the world, not us. Mm. Yeah, I'm going to tool them up.
That's fantastic, because I'll share a little story with you. Years ago, of course, you came to when I was the librarian and met you, and was very happy to do that. And I think I got you up to the school when
you did, yeah.
I was the librarian, or maybe I'd just gone back to a classroom. But the kids thought it was fabulous. Isabel turned up dressed to the nines, with dripping with earrings, and it was just magnificent. And then she just took over, and it was inspiring for the kids. Those same kids, a few years later, I was in the classroom and I started to teach them writing, and probably because of people like you, I wasn't satisfied for them just to do the recount. So we got into some other stuff. And one of the very first things I did, I don't know why I did it, but it worked, I read them some of your work. I just stood up and read this. And when I was finished reading, I said, now you write something like that.
Oh, but actually, you know, that's, aside from the fact that it's an incredible compliment, it's a brilliant way to work. And I do it too. I read really brilliant stuff, because you can say all the things you like theoretically about writing, but the writing itself is the thing that gets them excited, I find. Yeah, so I think it's a great idea. I'm honoured that you think I was worthy of that.
Oh, I definitely did. And I don't know why I did it. I was obviously inspired, but I, you know, back in those days, we were a bit more free in the classroom and we could try things. And this absolutely worked. In fact, I'll say it on air, my son married one of the girls who wrote probably the best piece that afternoon, and I wish to God that I had kept it, Christabel. I don't have it.
Oh, what a shame.
It was a beautiful piece of writing, and I couldn't believe she'd written it, and I thought from that day forward I've never underestimated what kids could do.
No, like in the workshop last night, there were quite a lot of adults, there were some children, and there was one little boy, I think he was from Nauru or something like that, and he read the most brilliant piece, and he just wrote it there in the session, and I just said to him afterwards, of all the pieces of writing I've heard today, this is the one I want to say to you, keep writing so I know what's I want to know what happens next. It was brilliant, his word choice, and he was younger than almost everyone else in the class, so that age thing is irrelevant when it comes to writing.
That's been my experience too, and that's why I asked you about schools, because I've had lots of joyful times with kids and writing. I've been very lucky to have a couple of jobs that have allowed me to do that. And one of them, you'll recall, I used your image to get kids to write descriptively, and that worked a treat. And you came around and gave me permission, which was good because I'd already shared it with 300 or more kids.
Oh, you knew me well enough.
I did, yeah.
I think it's interesting, Isabel, when you say, you know, you delight to hear people realise the power of words. I think also, maybe it's true of what you were saying about that young boy, the power of brevity too. Sometimes kids...
And you're saying this to me. His last book was, 1,300?
But it's not the length of the book. It's the, you know, the way that you can describe an idea. Sometimes kids get really tied up because they think that they have to have, you know, big words or lots of words, and they don't appreciate the value of a single image and a simple sort of idea.
I'm not sure I agree with that, because what I remember when I was a kid, I used words regularly. I had no idea what they meant. They were just beautiful. Nacreous. What might that mean? A nacreous sky. I didn't know what that thing, but I could have looked them up in a dictionary, but sometimes I just thought I'd wing it.
Yeah.
And not only that, a teacher wrote on my work, Isabel Carmody is overfluent. And by that they meant I jammed every single word I could, every adjective. I had a joy of adjectives. There were millions of them. At university, Isabel, this is very purple prose. And I loved it, the lushness of it. Yeah. People all through my childhood said, you can't do that. You can't put that many adjectives. And I thought, yeah, I know, but I really want to. And then I read Angela Carter, and I thought, yes, you can. You can break every single rule. You can put all those words in. Brevity is, however, exquisite. You know, I love Ursula Le Guin. She's my personal heroine, and she is the soul of brevity and sparse writing. Yeah. And she uses very few adjectives. But there's also the beauty of a writer like Angela Carter, who uses millions of adjectives. And kids in class often say to me, I really like to use a lot of adjectives, but my teacher says I can't. And I always say, yes, you can. And you can tell her or him I said so. The only rule is they've got to be the right adjectives, and they've got to be perfect, and they've got to be original, and you've got to question every single one to be sure that that's a perfect adjective. You can't just ram a whole bunch of adjectives in there. You've got to question every single one of them. Yeah. So,
I know what you mean. I was thinking more like sometimes you can have really young children who write three or four sentences, and it's just... There's an honesty in those words that they chose that, you know, mightn't in anybody else's eyes mightn't be seen as something sort of marvellous, but they just, there's a rawness to them that is
beautiful.
No, you're
right.
And
that
children
raw writing. I think the most exciting groups I've ever worked with as writers was English as second language groups, because, you know, in schools they're considered to be bad writers or not very good at English. And so you're sent with them, you know, as a way of kind of, I suppose, babysitting them, trying to help them. But they were thrilling to me because it's only language, but they have the most, many of them had stories. None of the other kids had any idea what was inside those kids, the kind of life some of them had lived. And this is back quite a long time ago when I was doing a lot of work with English as second language kids. And that sense of rawness and that brokenness, that lack of grammatical English, it just simply doesn't matter. Mm. When the story is riveting, getting them to write that out first, because the rest is just technique. You can work on it, you can make it better, but to have a story to tell, to have something to tell, that's perhaps the most important thing.
Yeah.
I think most kids have got more imagination than their teachers, I'd have to say, and that's particularly true in my case.
Well, it's interesting because in Bendigo there was one talk that was given where everybody, where we had a largely child audience of, I think, 700 kids on one day. And then another, the next day, when the festival, the main festival started, it was predominantly adults, many with grey hair. So it was that's the kind of typical festival audience. And someone commented afterwards, God, one of the techs said to me afterwards, God, the kids' questions were so much better. And it was interesting. It was just because adults are very aware, it's what you said before about honesty. Adults are very aware of who is going to perceive their question. They're aware that they're being watched. Kids, when they ask a question, they just want to know the answer. And it's usually something interesting.
What's the curliest or best question that you can recall a kid asking you?
The best question is always one no one's ever asked you before. Mm-hmm. And those can be really, you know, I can't think of them any. I've never had a question that was so riveting that I've remembered it. Mm. But I have had questions that really stopped me and made me think. And sometimes a question makes you realise something you didn't know about your writing. Mm. Like somebody said to me, you know, a lot of people die in fire in your books. And I thought, what? And then I realised, oh my, it wasn't even something I'd realised I'd done. Not a lot, but I mean, it's happened in my books before, but I hadn't realised that. I hadn't thought about that. And one kid said, when you talk a lot about death, miss. So I thought, do I? I said, yeah, I'm probably on a roll today. I don't know why. But yeah, so they audiences can tell you things you don't know about yourself. And those are the questions that really stop you in your tracks.
Isabel, the actual process of writing, I know when I first met you and I was fascinated with the way you went about your writing. You told me at that stage that you wrote in longhand. Do you still do that?
Yeah, I have two pens in my bag right now, and I'm waiting eagerly to get my next pen. That's going to be made of lava. And I've bought the green Irish ink that I'm going to mix with a little bit of yellow ink to make the colour I want. So each book that I write, I mix a new ink for. Sometimes I find the right colour, but usually I mix the inks. I'm like an alchemist. And sometimes with the Red Queen, I look like I'd killed someone half the time because I had red hands all the time. So I'm always stained with ink if I'm working.
And longhand, particularly because...
Well, as a journalist, I was a journalist a million years ago, and I still use quite a lot of weird longhand. Mm. But no, it's mostly longhand. I use it quite a lot of shorthand, but mostly it's longhand, yeah.
One of the sad things that I think has happened in schools is that kids rely too much on computers. And I had a rule in my room where the kids were not allowed to write a first draft on computer. Most of the time they ignored me, but whenever I caught them and made them go back, it did work.
Yeah.
I think that there is a connection between your brain through your hand to the page that's just broken.
I 100% agree, and I really hate it when kids sit in my classes and start tapping on. I don't ever say no because maybe that's the way they work and they've got used to working to it. But what in the hell do kids do when they go to an exam and they've got to write and half of them cannot hold the pen and write the pages they're going to have to write? Even that alone is problematic. But you're right about it's a different thing that you do. And the reason I still write is that when you write it the first time, it's you have to rewrite it. You know you're going to have to rewrite the whole thing. And also, you know it's rough when you look at it. You can't tidy it up, spell check it, grammar check it and think that's it, it's ready to go. You know that you're on a first draft when you handwrite it. And there is that, you know, there's just that beauty of having a pen and having the ink and having the page where you can take to the beach, you can sit anywhere. And, you know, our tech-savvy kids would say, well, I can do that with my iPhone. I just simply don't think it's the same. And I also know that if you translate all that you've written into a computer, you'll make much bigger changes and be much more muscular in your alterations than you will if you've put it into a computer in the first place. And I think it makes you lazy. And it makes you mentally lazy. When I start putting it into a computer, it's a very different mental process I'm in. It's editing, but I don't think of editing as something separate from the creative process. Editing is an essential part of the creative process. And the problem with most schools is it's dislocated from the creative process. It's seen as this thing you do afterwards, this boring thing the teacher wants me to do, instead of a beautiful, essential part of the creative process. Mm. And I really like running editing workshops where I can show people what editing actually can be. This beautiful process. It's not boring to edit. It's deep, and it's where you start moving from the conscious things you've written into the threads that are actually attached to the subconscious stuff that's dying to get into your piece of writing or get out of your piece of writing if you just had the wit to give yourself the time. Mm. And of course, the time is a factor too. If you've handwritten a piece and then you then have to type it, the chances are you're not going to do it in the same day. And, you know, then you've got that amount of time when the piece of writing you've done consciously off the front of your mind moves into your subconscious, and you wake up the next morning and you find you're full of thoughts or just below the surface, so that when you start to write, that starts to come out. So you're starting to use that incredible, you know, subconscious that you've got there, all the stuff in your unconscious, all of your memories that are not immediately accessible, you're starting to reach down into them. And the editing process, the gaps of time, writing things down, all of that helps you to reach deeper into yourself.
I think that, well, Lee, you might be able to help me out here. I think that one of the sad things that's happened in schools is that we don't give ourselves the time for that. And maybe it's got something to do with the testing regimes that are going on now and the time pressures that are there in every classroom. But the idea of setting kids, it's very easy for the kids to argue and ignore the fact that, you know, they don't want to write by hand because they won't ever finish it, or else they won't want to go back to it. And I'd probably be like every other teacher, guilty of giving in every now and then and saying, OK, we'll just put it on computer.
Yeah, because you get something at least that way. Yeah. But I think you're
and
right
you can
about
show you've got something.
Yes. Yeah.
I think exactly. That's a really interesting point. As you were talking, Isabel, I was thinking that's so true that kids, when they're working on computers, they as soon as they get something down, it has a more finished look, and it encourages that sort of laziness, I think, because it makes them feel like they've done a professional job because it looks like type does in a newspaper or in a book, and. If they had used that process like you were describing of handwriting and then transcribing it into electronic form, that would encourage that editing. And it's very hard to get students to do that because, like you say, they think it's boring.
I think it's also what Randall was saying about the overall, you know, culture of thinking in schools, which is infused by the culture of thinking in our society, which is do as much as you can, as fast as you can, and all for the bottom line. Mm. And I don't just necessarily mean money, I mean marks or whatever you've got to get, the score at the end. Right. It's all that instant gratification of this, which, you know, and what? Why? How could we blame kids or young writers or any writers from wanting to get from the beginning to the end line? And it's starting to muddle the whole process together. There's nothing that we do in life that allows us, that encourages us, that rewards us for taking our time and doing it well and enjoying the process. That is not the thing you get rewarded for. That's considered to be lazy, malingering, you know. My motto is embrace chaos. You know, I'm all about chaos theory, because from all of that, you know, from that relaxing into these things, for reaching into education and finding what you can for it, what works for you, what connects to you, just would be such a much more rich process than kids who are taught by teachers who are themselves the poor things, beleaguered by the need to fulfill NAP plan or IB or whatever it is they're doing. And, you know, my daughter's doing IB this year, and she hates it, and yet she's loved it. But she says it's all about the bottom line. It's all about the mark I get, and I don't care. And she told her teacher, I don't care about your valuation of me. And her teacher said to me, I didn't know whether to slap her or hug her because I know that I want her to pass. But she said, you want me to pass because you want good marks. Mm. And I just thought, isn't that the truth, though, in a way?
Well, it's interesting to say that. It shouldn't be all about education, but I think that there is it's ill-conceived in society that teachers actually are trying to prove themselves to society or other teachers. Most teachers I know are not. They're just getting about doing their job. But what has happened is there is God almighty pressure for the bottom line and getting marks, and it's at a school level. If the schools don't do well, they lose students, etc. So the teachers do get it put on them. And how it translates is is that they basically end up writing pages and pages of reports. And
that's exactly what I was going to say. The paperwork, and I can't tell you how many schools I, because of course I hear all this in staff room after staff room, in school after school, that teachers spend so much of their time writing these reports. And one of the teachers I bumped into up skiing said to me, I just want to be able to think up exciting, creative lessons for my students and do those lessons with them. But I'm anxious because I'm up at night trying to fill miles of paperwork. I mean, what sort of sense is there in that?
There's no sense in it.
And it's the business model of education.
Exactly. Education was corporatised by Jeffrey Kennedy in the 1990s, and I think we've never gone forward since.
The other thing, though, Isabel, what you're saying about, you know, the attention to the bottom line, there's an inherent sort of contradiction in all that because, you know, everyone is, conscious of the need to get good marks because it's kids' futures, etc. But unless they actually embrace language and embrace the power of language, they don't actually achieve that bottom line. You know what I mean? You have to get them to have that interest in words and language, both in what they read and the language they use themselves. Otherwise, they never get that level of mastery, which actually gives them the good marks. Yeah. You know, it's very hard.
I suspect, you know, the whole bottom line thing is a bit of a fallacy anyway, because how many kids are studying law who are going to get out and not find a job because there are no jobs out there? Because it's an industry of selling degrees. Mm. You know, education is business. A lot of kids are doing extremely well being homeschooled. You know, homeschooled kids are doing incredibly well this year. NAPLAN kids are not doing very well. You know, like, and that's partly what is the use of it all anyway? Because so many people, if I just look at us, how many of us started out studying one thing and actually do that today? Mm. You don't. And who said that you do just one thing in your life? If you count every 10 years as a lifetime, and they often are in our lives, can't we do something new for everyone? Can't we have a new degree? Can't we study something different? I'm doing a PhD right now, and I'm in my 50s, and I think the next thing I'd like to do is do a degree of animation at the School of Film and Television. And someone said to me, but Isabel, look at the age of you. And I said, so what? I'm not old. I'm not dead. I can think, and I'd really like to know more about that. Mm. And it's not for a job. So people think, well, why would you do it if it wasn't for a job? I do it because I'm interested in it. And that's, it should be more embracing that we learn our whole life long, that we can try different things, that we can feel, that we can move from one thing to another. People should feel more easy in the thought that maybe I don't want to do this forever. Maybe I want to do this now and go on to do something else. The only thing you want to do forever is write.
This could be a very powerful combination for you, Isabel, if you went on to do an animation and you met some bright young thing.
That is my strategy. That is my, because look, I'll have access to all those bright young students, cohort of students. And I'm so enjoying doing my PhD. And all I can think is, I would be able to draw them into a project that's a real project that we could get real funding for.
Yeah.
So I can see that there would be great power in that. And what is it? 3 years if they take me. 3 years. That's nothing.
Why wouldn't they take you?
Well, I'm hoping they feel that too.
Well, I can't think of a reason why they wouldn't. But while we're on the subject of animation and pictures, in your body of work, there's some graphic novels or comics. Do you want to talk about that? Do you do the illustrations?
I do. I illustrate the Little Fur books and the Red Wind. I illustrate those smaller books with, they each have maybe 100, 120 black and white drawings in and a cover. I'm not an illustrator, though. I know nothing about perspective. I just draw and I like it. And because they're my books, I get to do it. I actually talked the publishers into it because I'd written Little Fur and I really wanted to, I didn't want it to be anyone else's version of Little Fur, but mine and my daughter's. So I took her $3 paint box from the supermarket and I drew these four drawings and I sent them with the proposal to the publishers and said, here's the book, but here's the catch. I really want to do my own drawings. And they said, yes. So, and then I realized this horrifying thing, but now I have to do it. And they said, we're thinking about, you know, 50 drawings. And I thought, 50 drawings in pen and ink? Part of me was elated and part of me was really frightened because drawing at home for my own pleasure was lovely, but people would look at it mm-hmm. and judge it. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of freaked out at the thought of that. And so I thought, I'll just draw a lot of drawings. So I did 150 drawings wow. for the first book. And I sent them to the publisher thinking, okay, they'll decide which ones. And they used all of them. And I was, so then I had to do that for every other book as well. But it was lovely. It's a lovely process. I don't have it written on any of my books that I'm the illustrator. And I often have the pleasure of someone saying, who was the illustrator? And I say it and they say, oh, so you see that they're impressed by the idea of it. But because I didn't train as an illustrator, I don't want to make a big thing of it. The graphic novels are something different. Dreamwalker is a hybrid. I would say it's not a graphic novel because as a writer and a lover of books and words, I don't want just pictures. Mm. I want both. And while I loved comics as a kid, I want more than that. I want more words. I want more space for the words. And I sometimes only want words. So my first proposal for a hybrid, which enabled the pictures to be there, and what I wanted with Dreamwalker was pictures that were as sophisticated and complicated as the words I wanted to write. And I think Dreamwalker, I'm really, really happy with Dreamwalker, very proud of it. Stephen Woolman, who did the illustrations, has died now. But we had a wonderful, you know, interaction. He didn't want to do it at first because I refused to do it the way you're supposed to do it, which is that you write the words, you give them to the publisher, they go to the illustrator, and they prevent you at all costs from ever speaking to one another. And I said, no, I don't want to do it like that. I want to talk with him regularly. And no illustrator wants to do that. But in every case that I've done it, it's been a rich, after their horror, a rich and rewarding and wonderful process where I've become really close friends with the person that I've worked with. And, you know, and it's a great process. You build something greater than the two of you would do otherwise. Yeah. And Evermore, which is one of my most recent pieces of work out, Evermore's, I would say it's an apocalyptic fairy tale.
All of your books are apocalyptic.
That too. I'm very fond of the apocalypse. I mean, fictionally speaking.
Yeah. Is there competition's not the right word, but is there a clash between the written word and the pictures? Is there a time when the written word, the pictures don't live up to it, or the pictures take over in a way they shouldn't?
For me, the words always come first. And the lovely thing about being able to go back and forwards with an illustrator is sometimes with Evermore, Dan Reed would say to me, he'd send me the illustrations. I'd say, show me what you want to draw here. And he'd send it to me. And I'd think, oh, my gosh, that's so beautiful. That's what's happening. And I'd cut most of the words.
Yeah.
Or sometimes he'd send me a really great illustration, but I'd like my words better. And I'd say to him, you know what? I'd rather the words here. You know, I like the idea that the reader will form that picture in their own mind. And while your picture's beautiful, that is the only picture they're going to see. And sometimes I just want words. Words are not just evoking pictures. In fact, they don't evoke pictures often for me. They evoke some kind of some feeling, which a picture doesn't do, and a picture stops you from seeing if you're reading words next to it. So when there are words that I like, that I just really love, I just don't want any distraction. I don't want a picture. So, yeah, there is someone. And the illustrators I've worked with have always been very respectful of that process. And also, but probably because I'm also very ready to get rid of the words if they've done something really special or they want to draw something and I will write around that so that can be in there. So it's really a collaboration process. Although the funny thing about words and pictures, it's funny you should say that, Randall, because what I discovered when I started to try and illustrate was that the minute I start to draw, I stop writing. And I mean, I don't write anything. I don't want to write letters. I stop answering emails. I don't do anything. I just illustrate. And it's like you let go of the word part of your mind and you enter into the illustration. And in that period, all I'm reading are books with Edward Gorey's illustrations or, you know, I'm reading the Moomin Trolls, but I'm not looking at the words. I'm looking at the illustrations, Lillian Hoban's words in lovely little illustrations in Russell Hoban's Mouse and His Child. Those are the illustrations that attract me. Illustrations for Dante's Inferno, you know, archaic illustrations in old books, lithographs and aquatints, all of them lines and ink. And I get really into those things and I've always got a great big pile of them waiting to be read. And Japanese manga comics, some of them are, my brother has a series of incredible illustrated comics. They're illustrations of Musashi's, do you know this book called Musashi's book? I think it might be the title of the book might be Musashi, and it's an amazing book. But it's illustrated in these in this volumes. He's got like about 130 of them, volumes of utterly exquisite graphic novels, and they're exquisite because, again, we go to the instant gratification. They do not gratify you instantly, so that you may see on one page, one frame with the character with a knife about to stab someone. And then you see a butterfly above him, just in, and then the picture, the next 17 pictures will show you the butterfly flying and internal, and then it might show you some book about butterflies. So there are all sorts of delicious digressions that take you far away from this moment. And then you might come back, but not to the knife, but to a drop of sweat going down the wrist of the character. And there's just something beautiful about the drawings, the hyper-realism of those incredibly exquisite drawings that makes me really wish I'd stolen one of them at my brother's house the last time I was there.
I hope he's not listening.
No, he lent me a pile and he deliberately addicted me, so it's his fault. But I should have I borrowed one, because now that I'm talking about it, I'm going home tonight to draw and I'm thinking, why didn't I get one of those books?
It sounds to me what you just described is very much like the gap that writers give to the reader. So the readers create the picture, and it sounds like those pictures allowed the reader to get into the creation process.
You are such a kindred spirit, because that is exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. That gap is everything in writing. And a good illustrator doesn't just fill the gap. They create their own gaps, or they use the gaps, but they produce more gaps. So it's this kind of like telescoping process. Yeah, the gap is everything. It's what you don't say. And maybe it's what you were kind of saying before too about, you know, brevity. It's the gap. It's the things that you don't tell, so that if a child, sometimes children's language is exactly this, they'll say something and then they'll say something else and they don't describe it and they don't judge. That's the most illuminating thing. You can always tell when a child's talking, because, or you can make it seem like a child is speaking in a novel when you just stop judging. And I don't mean in the obvious sense of being judgmental. I mean a child says, "Mama slammed the cup down on the sink and water splashed out," and that's all they'll say. Now, if it's an adult watching that, you'd say, and then you'd speculate about it. Mm-hmm. And that lovely gap that a child would leave sometimes allows you to think, well, what, why did that happen? What is happening here? And that gap, yeah, the gap is everything. Like shadows in illustrations, the illustrations, the light and the colour, the light and the dark are everything.
Mm. It's a fascinating topic, because I know in my classrooms and just in life personally, it is such a hard thing to do, especially in teaching, because we basically fill every gap with our own voice. Most teachers, I did anyway.
Well, no, I do the same, but you're right. It's also that need to invoke in people a search for that kind of gap in their life in which stuff can happen. I have this technique I will share with you and all of our listeners now. I call it impressionist writing. And it comes from something I used to do with my daughter. When she would say this terrible phrase that I hate, she would say, "I'm bored." And I'd say, "Really, you're bored?" And this would happen in Prague, because we lived there for 10 years. And she would say, "I'm bored." I'd say, "Really, you're bored?" She'd say, no, I'm not bored." And I'd say, "Too late. Get your pen and your notepad." So she'd get her pen and her notepad. I'd get mine. And we'd go and we'd get a tram. And the trams in Prague can go for an hour and a half. They're really long. They go through great neighbourhoods, seedy neighbourhoods. People get on, fill up, get out, fill up, get out. So a lot happens on a tram journey. And so I'd sit her, and this was when she was 7 and 6, on a tram somewhere and say, "You sit there and you keep your notebook." And what she understood, that we were like spies and we would sit there and we had to write, not in sentences, but just a list of everything that we saw that people did or said or wore, or anything we saw out the window that was interesting, and we had to make a list. And that hour-long train journey, we weren't allowed to speak. She didn't have anything with her and neither did I. So you would just sit and do that. And then at the end of it, you'd get off, you'd get back on again, and you'd do the same thing. And when we got all the way back, we would go to the ice cream shop. She would have an ice cream, I'd have a coffee, and then she would read it out to me. And I can tell you, she wrote exquisite things over the years. And as the years passed, we both got better and better at it. And I realised that in that time you sat and observed the world, you were enriching your vocabulary, you were improving your ability to notice the minutiae of life, to notice details of things happening around you. You noticed the weather. You noticed how many movements a person simply sitting makes. You noticed all the weird things you did because, of course, we observe one another too. And so, you know, you'd discover all of those things. And in these, we would sometimes speculate. A mother would slap her child and Adelaide would say that mother slapped her child. Or the father would, Adelaide was always very judgmental about fathers. And she noted when she was very young that fathers were careless of their children. She wrote that in one of her notes once. Fathers are very careless of their children. And she said a mother would always put a child on the inside of the chair. The father would just sit them careless and they often fell off the seat at the end. So she would observe this general carelessness of fathers. So these kind of little life philosophies. And when I run workshops, especially when they're day-long workshops or even weekend workshops, I always send my people out to do some impressionist writing. And that means they have to choose a place and go sit somewhere for an hour. And I recommend it for all of us to do, to sit somewhere. So if you're going to meet someone for a movie, go half an hour early and just sit there. And don't take your damn phone out and look at it for the whole time. God. Don't take any implement out. I mean, I am as guilty as hell, like anyone else, of being distracted by my phone. I love it that where I live on the Great Ocean Road near Apollo Bay, I am in a dead zone. I cannot get any internet reception. I can barely get phone reception. I don't have a landline. I don't have a television. And there, my life is mine. I'm sacrosanct and I'm away from all of that stuff. So at least for the period you're sitting down, just live for a while, because what can we write if we don't observe the world, if we don't look up occasionally from what's around us? You know, I saw this lovely cartoon on the internet the other day with a Pokemon riding a human being walking along with their phone, and I just thought that was just so accurate and so funny.
Yeah, the Pokemon thing just leaves me cold. I can't understand any of it. I don't understand it. I guess that's just a comment about my age.
Well, I think it's just I can understand why it would be fun. It's just a fun thing to go out and hunt for something.
But you hunted much. Your hunts were much better when you took Adelaide out on the dreams.
Yeah,
much better. They
were. I hope you kept those books.
Some of them. I've kept some of the stories she wrote.
Yeah.
When she was little, and she said to me the other day, I couldn't write books, Mama, because we're talking about what she might do now because she's 18 and she's at the end of secondary school. And she's saying, I said, you could write. And she said, oh, no, I can't write. And I said, are you crazy? You wrote such good books that one of my editors, when she was very young, like 9 or something, saw a book she'd written and was reading it and said to me, if that came across my desk, I'd publish that. But I didn't want that for her. I didn't want that, you know, precocious stuff for her, because I want her to unfold as she unfolds. Mm. I don't care about success. I don't care about, you know, marks. I don't care about the bottom line with her, which is probably why she's so mouthy to her teachers. I know what she cares about. I know that she'll spend hours and hours and nights without sleeping on her music or on a piece of theatre that she's really interested in, but she won't hand her maths homework in, even though she's done it, and she'll lose marks because of it. And it drives me mad because it's just a technical thing. Just take it into the school and you'll get the mark. But she says, I will get a calculator, or I will marry someone who can count. But I am not going to be the person who does this in my life. I try to say to her that mathematics is a different way of thinking, and it, embracing these things, you know, it's a good thing. And she said, I'm sure you believe that, Mama. You believe it with all of your heart, but I don't.
Well, lucky we're not got any maths teachers here to take issue with that. We're out of time here on the book show. Okay. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Isabel for coming in with some fantastic things for us to think about there. Thanks also to Kathy Donovan, Miranda Fitzgerald. You've been listening to Apollo Bay Radio and the book show. Next week on the book show, there'll be a science focus with Dennis Sharples, Les Cameron, Brian Dwyer, of course, and others. Thanks for listening.